business as we go. I'd like to convene this February 5th meeting of the Temple Board of Directors.
Arden
has joined the conference.
Welcome, Arden. We're just starting. I was just
opening
the session, and I'd just like to thank all of y'all for participating in today's meeting. I hope you don't mind that since it was a short meeting, I decided to have it be a teleconference rather than cause us all to travel to Austin, or at least some of us. So we'll call the meeting to order, and the first action of order of business is the approval of the minutes. Do we have any changes to the minutes? If none,
move
can
approval.
I have a second?
This is Bobby.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Good. The minutes are approved then. I guess the next item of business is the annual meeting, and I'd like to propose that we hold our annual meeting on April 22nd, 2015. If everybody's in agreement with that, if I can have, I guess we're going to have a motion on that. Is that right, Bruce?
Yes, sir.
All right. Can I have a motion?
This is John White, so move.
That's a second.
So move.
All right. Motion carries. We'll have our annual meeting on the 22nd. Next item of business is a resolution of appreciation for Francisco Figueroa. I will not read all of that today because it's been in our material, but I will say that, you know, in the time I've been on this board, we've looked at a number of resolutions of appreciation, and this particular one, I believe, is extremely important because in the time I've been here, Francisco has really, I think he's brought a lot to the meeting. He's got a lot of wisdom and a lot of judgment. We're definitely going to miss him. I know that Chancellor McRaven is going to bring as well some wise judgment and wisdom. But certainly we'll miss Francisco. And as we've said before, he's certainly welcome to stay in contact with us and continue to provide us guidance. So with that, can I have a motion to approve this resolution of appreciation?
So moved. Motion.
Okay. Second?
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Motion carried. All right, Bruce, I think you're up on the endowment and operating funds update.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. We did want to give you a funds update. The last time we updated you on the funds performance was at the end of October, and we covered the fiscal year that ended August 31. So we've got the first 4 months of results of the new fiscal year, September, October, November, December, and we can kind of tell you the start we're off to. But also, we've got kind of a full calendar year, and I know that we don't necessarily operate on a calendar year, but most of the world does, and so a lot of times when you think about returns and you hear a lot of things, it's helpful to put it in the context of a calendar year. But let me just start in Diligent, page 14. If you've got a paper copy, it's tab 3, page 2. We're still at about $34.5 billion. Through the end of December. By the way, we've got preliminary returns for January. It looks like it's going to be a slightly positive month, but that's preliminary. Because we have gotten contributions in, and at least on the PUF, we're not sending distributions out at the request of the UT system until March, we might get over that $35 billion mark by the end of January. But we're at the end of December, $34.5 billion, half of it in the Permanent University Fund, permanent health fund staying at $1.1 billion, long-term fund up to $7.1 billion, and the intermediate term fund up to $6.7 billion. The next page was the page that we put together coming out of some of the discussions this board had this past summer, where two directives seemed pretty clear to us. Number one, the board wanted to make sure that staff was very transparent with the board and with our clients about the risk that we face in investing these funds. And number two, try to communicate that in as straightforward and clear and concise as fashion as possible. So we put together this, what we call the endowment dashboard, where we had developed kind of 10 basic risks. That was a white paper that we shared back in August, and then looked to quantify those risks. And this is a one-page summary of that. I won't go over the summary because we're going to jump into each one of these areas in a little bit of detail over the next hour. And so if you turn to page 17 in Diligent, page 5, you know, the first risk is that we don't earn enough, that we underperform. And our goal is to make what the regions take. And, you know, traditionally that's been about a 5% distribution rate, 4.75, 5, more recently 5.75, this past year 7%. But to make that distribution rate plus inflation. And so if you look at the endowments, those numbers are, with the exception of the first 4 months of this fiscal year to date, if you look at the calendar year, about 7%, 3 years closer to 10, 5 years, 8.75, 10 years closer to 7, we've been in that zip code. Inflation's been low, 2.3, as low as 1. And so that would certainly support the distribution rates of kind of a 5%-ish distribution rate. Obviously not enough for a 7%. This year, for the first 4 months, we're down about 1%, a little bit more in the Permanent University Fund, a little bit more in the General Endowment Fund. We're also down in the Intermediate Term Fund. Although, again, over trailing 3-5 years, you know, there it's inflation plus 3%. So we've clearly been meeting those goals. And, in fact, if we exceed that, the UT system gets a bit of a carry, if you will. And they got a carry back in 08, and they got a carry this year. So I think it's in the neighborhood of $30 million. So that fund, I think, is working out real well since it was started about 8 or 9 years ago. On the next page, we just tried to do a graphic where we look at our portfolio, page 18 in Diligent 6 paper. Again, the columns here, we have MCC or long only on the left, LCC or hedge funds in the middle, privates on the right, investment grade fixed income at the top, then credit, then natural resource, then real estate, natural resources, developed country equity, emerging market equity. And for the first 4 months, this just shows kind of where we've been getting positive returns, green, where we've had some losses, real estate, commodities, some emerging markets, long-only emerging markets. And so it's just kind of a graphic depiction of where the portfolio's been returning and where it hasn't. And on the next page, this is for calendar year 14, where there's a lot less red, although, again, the natural resources long-only book wasn't as positive. And the hedge fund book, you know, was a bit more neutral. In order to be green, you had to be over that 7.5% mark, where that's where we're kind of earning what we're making, what the regions are taking, plus inflation. We'll go into each of the areas a little bit more when the investment officers give you the updates on their funds. The next page, we like to, you know, look as to how our endowments perform relative to other indices. The U.S. stock market continues to be a bull market, so even though it was substantially below the endowments back in 09, it's been on a rip and recently has exceeded the endowments. We saw that before, back in the 99-2000 range. Our portfolio continues to beat a more traditional 60-40 U.S.-focused portfolio, again, even though the U.S. stock market and, frankly, U.S. bond market's been well. And obviously, portfolio, well, I shouldn't say obviously, but the portfolio's exceeded bonds and treasury bills. Next page, we just this is kind of how we've done versus what we thought we were going to do. And the green line is how we've done. The red line is how we thought we were going to do. There have been times we've been above it, times we've been below it. We're kind of right on it. The orange line is kind of the passive policy benchmark, which is below it. Because of the value add, we've managed to stay on the line. Turning to the next risk, which is market risk, because we can't earn enough without taking risk, T-bills won't do it for us.
Bruce, I'm sorry to interrupt. Can we go back to that last page, and just maybe you could comment on whether you think it's an issue for the board to consider whether that the policy level, in other words, just a passively managed investment that follows the policy, falls that far below expectations over time?
No, I don't think.
I mean, you're getting back there with your management skill, you know, the value added, but
yeah.
Is it a problem that policy alone isn't where we would expect it to be?
I don't think so. It'd be nice if it were, but we've seen periods like this before. You know, it's a long-term approach, so, you know, even 4 or 5 years isn't necessarily the long term. So, no, I'm not too worked up over it. So going to back to the second risk of market risk, which we have to take, if you look on page 23 in Diligent, page 11 in your paper copy, I think this is kind of interesting because, first of all, at the top, what it shows is we have a 0.53 beta. What that means is if the U.S. stock market goes up 100, we'd expect to go up 53, or down 100, down 53. By the way, we're negative to interest rates. Interest rates go down, we'd expect to go up. Again, dollar down, 25 cents up, or 1% down, a quarter of a percent up. And also negative to the U.S. Dollar, a negative relationship. Dollar goes up, we would expect to go down some. But if you look at calendar year 14 on the right, a lot of press about how the S&P 500 was up 13.7%. And so, you know, it's like, well, how come we weren't up 13.7%? We were up 6.8%. And the reason is because we don't invest exclusively in U.S. equities. By the way, had we been really, really smart, we would have put all the money in China, which was up 48% for the year. And maybe even if we weren't that smart, but smarter than we are, we would have put the money in India, which was up 27%. But as you can see, the only other capital market that you know really was positive was TIPS, the global bonds slightly positive. But a lot of the markets, the commodity complex, Europe, Tokyo, Japan, Brazil, Russia, a lot of, you know, we're down quite substantially. You know, that's just what happens with a diversified portfolio. And you know, occasionally all the markets will be up, occasionally all the markets will be down, but most of the time some will be up and some will be down. And in fact, if you look over at the first 4 months on the left, the first 4 months, again, China had all their, you know, explosive growth the last 4 months of the fiscal of the calendar year, the first 4 months of our fiscal year, and the S&Ps continue to be strong, but every other market from September through December, every other broad capital market was down. The next page does show, it gets at that sensitivity to our portfolio vis-a-vis the U.S. stock market. And I mentioned the headline number of 0.53, but that's made up of two components. One, how do we do when the stock market's up? And here we capture 62% of the ups. And then how do we do when the stock market's down? We only suffer 36% of the down. So we're not immune, but we do have a better up capture than down capture, which we think is helpful. We added this next page because we clearly have a global portfolio, so to just look at our up-down capture versus U.S. stocks wasn't necessarily as full a picture. We look at the world index, and we have a slightly higher up capture, but also a slightly higher down capture. Uzi's done a lot of work on this, and part of where he's concluded, and you don't have this in front of you, is that we tend to kind of get the market average plus 50 basis points. Every month. Now, that ought to put us about, I guess that's the U.S. equity market, so that's why we're not 6% over our benchmark every year. But You know, we'll do a little bit more work on this up-down capture, but this is a, you know, I think it does give you some insight into the portfolio. Given that we take market risk, the third risk is really a subset of market risk, and it's scenarios. You know, I mentioned the happy scenario when everything's up or the sad scenario when everything's down. That typically is not the case, but there are substantial, significant events that have occurred and no doubt will occur. And so what we try to do is look forward, and we try to think about what events might occur, and we tend to, as Dr. Brown's pointed out, dwell on the negatives that would hurt us. And you've seen this before. If the U.S. precipitously and dramatically raises rates, that could put a real dull, that could really hamper returns. If China really crashes, that could hurt returns. We've looked at Europe, we've looked at Japan, we've looked at kind of currency wars, we looked at kind of a slow fade in Europe, we were looking at a oil shock where oil prices skyrocketed, and clearly the last 6 months we've had a situation where oil prices have plummeted. And Uzi, working with the other senior investment officers, went through and did analytics, and our best guess, our best projection, is that supply shock, excess supply, lower prices, is actually a slight positive for the endowment. Now, it's clearly a negative for the energy industry, clearly a negative for the state of Texas. At least I think it's clearly a negative for the state of Texas. But this really gets at that around 10% of our exposure is in energy. 90% is outside of energy. And so while the oil price decline hurts suppliers of energy, it helps consumers of energy. And that, you know, will translate, should translate, and so far really has translated or beginning to translate into stronger, you know, economic growth as consumers have more money in their pocket and buy things. This will be a topic that next week at the Regents meeting, I'm not going to attend. I can't attend. Mark Warner's going to stand in. And it's a topic that Chancellor McRaven in particular suggested that he thought that he and the Regents would be interested in. So Mark will spend some time on it at the Regents meeting next week. You know, I know it's probably the kind of the one of, if not the single biggest topic in capital markets right now. So let me just pause in case anyone has any questions or if Mark or Uzi or anyone wants to add anything. Okay. And then, you know, the next page, 28 in diligence, 16 in your board books, these are the normal, what we call historic scenarios that we've looked at that have occurred, everything from the 08 crisis on the right, the 87 market crash, you know, Russian crash, et cetera, and what we would project would happen to our portfolio, and just as a point of comparison, the S&P. So we both try to be forward-looking to think about shocks or scenarios that might occur, and then are also kind of cognizant of historic shocks that have occurred. The fourth risk is volatility risk. And Kyle's not here. Arden's on the phone. You guys have labored mightily to help us understand that volatility is not the single risk. It is a risk, but not the single risk. But we do look at volatility. And this is relative to we have a volatility budget, if you will, along with our asset allocation targets and ranges. And what this chart represents on page 30 in Diligent, page 18, is that we're right at our target or our budget, if you will, on volatility, the volatility aspect of the risk spectrum. And the next page is a new page. What Uzi did was take that overall volatility for the overall portfolio and try to look at where that comes from, what portions of the portfolio it comes from. We really only got one manager that represents more than 3% of our volatility. It is ValueAct, a long-only manager with a very concentrated portfolio, kind of an activist strategy. We've been with for, gosh, a decade?
11
years, and they've done exceedingly well for us. We've got some blues, again, primarily in our long-only book. The blues you see in the hedge fund or LCC book are really with some managers that run both long-only and hedge funds for us. And then, you know, we've got some 1% to 2% positions. Again, some of our larger hedge fund managers in the commodity complex, still in long-only. And then where we've got some concentrated positions in private investments in our energy book and in our venture capital book, that's Union Square Ventures and Foundry, and then in the emerging market private book with Emerald Hill and Helios. But
Bruce, just for clarification, I think this is a new presentation that's actually pretty neat, but are the sizes of the box then related to the dollar allocation to the manager? And then you're color coding the risk contribution?
No, it's all scaled to risk.
Okay. So there's not a dollar representation.
I'm sorry. It's all scaled to volatility, not risk. It's all scaled to volatility. We are trying to re-educate ourselves. Arden, you got to be patient with us. To no longer refer to volatility as risk.
So I'm sorry. So the dollar investments with the managers is not represented on this chart?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
By the way, you know, again, just as kind of a comment, for example, Hill House is not shaded. It is a Chinese mandate we have. It's mostly long, but they do some illiquid stuff. They have a lot of and we do have, you do see a little slug over in privates, and you know a slug there at the bottom. It is a larger dollar mandate. And by the way, I think that it is, you know, if I was to say what are our riskier positions, I would say Hill House is a riskier position. It's in China. It's a larger dollar mandate. The manager's got a tremendous amount of discretion, tend to take fairly concentrated positions. Now, we are with, you know, we stay very close to them. Amanda and Susan and Russ and Kyle and I spent an hour reviewing it week before last, so we're very, and they've had tremendous returns for us, so we're comfortable with it, and it doesn't show up on this volatility chart as a, you know, as a bright color, but that's, you know, just where I think, again, as we try to think about the different risks in the portfolio, it's why we've gone to more of a dashboard and kind of looked at it in 10 various, you know, 10 components rather than say, you know, the kind of go to the conventional definition that volatility is risk. The fifth risk is active management. The first risk was underperformance, which we would experience if we didn't take any risk, if we just invested in T-bills. The next set of risk was because we did participate in capital markets, then we made further decision, you've made and hired us to manage the portfolio more actively. And so what we look at is how was the performance relative to the policy portfolio or a less active or a passive approach. What you see on page 33, 21 in paper is our value add. Now, here's you know, so for the calendar year, this shows 107 basis points, $231 million, for example. And for the first 4 months, 66 basis points, $63 million. Just to give you an example of how this number can move around, after this book went out, we got new private equity benchmarks. By the way, they only went through September 30th, so we don't get the September 30th benchmark until late January. Well, when it came in, our value add for the first 4 months of the fiscal year, instead of being at 66 basis points, went up to 100 basis points. And for the calendar year, instead of being 107, went up to 180. Now, on a trailing 3 and 5 years, it didn't have as quite a significant an impact. The 148 went up to 160, 159 to 165. But I point that out just because, short-term performance, be it actual performance, be it the policy portfolio, be it value add, it can really move around in the short term. And particularly with things like private investments, where the book doesn't get marked every day, it gets marked really every quarter, and we get that information on a lagged basis. I really think it's most helpful to take a longer term perspective on everything, particularly value add. What I will say is that, you know, our returns relative to volatility, there's two measurements here, the Sharpe ratio and the information ratio. Those are good numbers, I think, by anybody's standards. When we dissect that value add, our starting point on the next page, page 34 in Diligent 22, is we start with our external managers, because that's really where we spend our time here at UTIMCO, trying to find excellent external managers. And if you look at the fiscal year, that 53 basis points with the new private investments, it's actually up to 87 basis points. But our long-only or MCC managers for 4 months delivering 105 basis points is really good. The hedge fund book, you know, candidly, 20 basis points wasn't as strong a 4 months as we're used to. The private, even though it's not negative 72 now, it's negative 38, still, you know, bounces around a bit. For the calendar year, that 111 basis points really, with a new benchmark, show at 184. But again, it wasn't our greatest year of external manager value add in the calendar year. And again, as the teams will talk about their portfolios, you'll get a better sense of where that worked and where it didn't. Because in some places it worked, and in some places it didn't. Again, over 3 and 5 years, we're right around that 250 is 268 for 3 years, 219 5 years before the change in the benchmark. And so, you know, that's what we're really targeting. What we're really shooting for is about two. If we can achieve 250 basis points of outperformance, that's what we look to do. The second thing we can do to try to beat a passive portfolio is to tactically allocate, underweight, overweight. And as you can see, going back 3 years, we did a lot more of that. 5 years and 3 years, we did a lot more of that, particularly the gold position. During the last calendar year and the first 4 months of the fiscal year, we've done essentially none of it. And then the final thing is we did buy some hedges, we called to kind of ensure, protect against some loss in the case of one of those dramatic negative scenarios we looked at earlier. And that cost us money, and we're not doing too much of it anymore. In fact, we have really got one hedge still in place on the Japanese yen and bonds, and that one's actually paying off for us. So just to highlight on the next page where we do have tactical allocations, I'm on page 35, Diligent 23 paper. Starting with the underweights, we are underweight in our long-only natural resources book. We were, as of the end of December, basically as commodities and equities sold off, that put us into an underweight position. We're slightly underweight in emerging markets, and we continue to be slightly underweight in private investments, a little bit more in the PUF because of the cash coming into the PUF. So the way we paid for that is we've been a little overweight in our long-only developed country equity book. That's kind of an offset. The way we think about it, it's kind of an offset in the private investment underweight. I mentioned the cash coming into the PUF, so that's kind of the overweight in the investment-grade fixed income. And then our hedge fund book, which continues to do well, it's been slightly overweight. But we are much, much closer to our targets. Other than private investments, we control that. And so we're looking to stay pretty close to our target. So we don't have a strict rebalancing policy. For example, in the natural resources area, our view where we were kind of 80, 75 basis points underweight to our targets is to get back to our targets, but not to do it all at once, to do it over a 3 or 4 month period. And then the insurance hedges on the next page, as I mentioned, the U.S. inflation is pretty much all spent. It's showing no value. I think it expires pretty soon. But the Japanese rate has actually been making us money, so that's a good one. And then finally, in terms of active management, the litmus test is did we add value relative to our policy portfolio? And we haven't quite cracked the $4 billion mark since 07, but we're getting close. The next risk is transparency risk. Because we operate with partners, or kind of what had been known as a fund-to-funds model, we don't always know every minute of every day, every security we hold. Now, in fixed income, we do. In our real asset, long-only real asset book, we do. And for 80% of our kind of long-only equity book, we do. Flipping over to the privates, we know what we own, but we don't know it immediately. We kind of tend to, there's about a three-month lag as we get quarterly updates from our managers. And in the hedge fund book, we don't have full transparency because we have very close relationships with our managers. We have a pretty good sense of what they own, top positions, sectors, geographies, and so we call that partial. The next risk is concentration risk, which we look at in a number of ways, starting with the asset allocation. Just to highlight, we have about 7.5% of our assets in long-only fixed income. We've got about 8.4% of our assets in credit-related, split between the hedge fund book and the private book. That continues to come down a bit. In real estate, we've got 2.5% of our assets in the long-only book, and we continue to build the private book. It's over $1 billion now, 4.1%. The long-only natural resources, that's really split in thirds. A third's the gold, a third are natural resources-related public equities, and a third are broad commodities. And again, we continue to build the private natural resource book. It's now over $1.6 billion, 6.4%. So, if you look at the far right, in total, we've got about 18% of our assets in fixed income, both investment grade and credit related, and 20% of our assets in real assets. So we still have about 62% of our assets in equities. In the long only,
John White
has left the conference.
In our long only book, 15% in developed country, 9% in emerging markets. Our hedge fund book remains about 30% of the portfolio, and our private equity books slightly under 28% of the portfolio. A second way we look at concentration is by geographic exposure. That's on the next page, page 42, in diligent, 30 in paper. 56% of our assets are still U.S.-based. That compares to 25%, or I should say North America. So I think it's 52 U.S. and 3 or 4% Canada. That compares to 25% of the world's GDP being North America and 40% of the world's public equity market capitalization. So we're still overweight the U.S. We are underweight Western Europe, for example. And you can just see the geographic dispersion there. On the next page, there's just another cut of the geographic dispersion. And again, it shows the U.S. at 54.3%. Japan, our second largest, China, our third largest. We went down to our 19th because we wanted Russia on the list. It's been a question on the minds of some regents, and Regent Cranberg did reach out to us via the Francie Frederick's office to let us know that next week, when my friend Mark Warner gets to give the update, he would also like a little update on Russia. You know, not much has changed. We have 0.6% of our assets in Russia. It's like a couple hundred million dollars. About a quarter of that is in the private investment book, which there's not too much we can do about that. We've got a little less than $100 million in a long-only Russian public equity mandate. We are underweight relative to a passive approach. But, you know, we do have the exposure. It has fared very poorly. It's down something like 40%. And so, but, you know, we're not adding to it. We're not selling it. We're just kind of staying put at this point. And then the next concentration we look at is sector exposure. I won't go into it, but, you know, fairly balanced across the various sectors. Then we look at manager concentration on page 45 in Diligent. And you can see our large positions in terms of relatively large to us, where we're large to our manager. And then lastly, when we do look through the portfolio to position level, our top 10 fixed income positions are 5.5% of our total book, almost a third of that being U.S. government. We still have some Lehman debt, some Mexican sovereign. We noticed that a number of our managers had some strong conviction in Argentinian debt, so we invested through one of our managers to increase that position. And then on the right, the top 10 equity positions, only 4%, and a lot of these names come from Value Act, who I mentioned before. Some come from Hill House, who I also mentioned before. The next risk we look at is liquidity risk, page 48 in Diligent, 36 paper. The blue line is how much illiquidity we have as measured in 90 days. So we're 60% illiquid in 90 days, or 40% liquid. The green line is 1 year, where we're 35% illiquid or 65% liquid. So basically, of the $25 billion in endowments, we think we could monetize in the area of $10 billion in 3 months, which is, you know, roughly 8 years of distributions, or 10 years of distributions, and almost $17 billion within a year. And then on the right side, it's not labeled. These are our unfunded commitments as a percentage of assets. I guess the vertical axis is labeled, where we're up at about 21%. I think our limit is 30%. Obviously, I'm talking too long. Everybody's leaving. Let me try to finish up. Leverage, we don't have too much. Leverage risk, page 50 in Diligent. I would say that our gold futures and our Korean and Taiwanese swaps are 100% cash backed. So they're really not that levered. Our forwards, Japanese forwards and emerging market, our currency forwards, start at zero. They're marked to market, so if we owe money, we put it up. We've actually made money, $52 million on our Japanese forwards, and we just recently re-rolled our emerging market forwards, but we're also positive there. And we do have some external managers operating under agency accounts that do use some derivatives, but again, it's mostly, you know, PIMCO, the fixed income managers, and then in natural resources, again, those are cash-backed, I believe. Our counterparty risk, we own, you know, everybody's A-minus or above. Goldman Sachs, this is as of December 31st, Citibank owed us $8 million, Goldman Sachs owed us $5 million. We think they're good for it. And then the last area of leverage we look at is in our hedge fund book, where on a gross basis, the global macro managers have been, namely Bridgewater, have been bringing it down. That's the black line. If we exclude the global macro, the leverage has been pretty consistent, about 175%, coming down some more. And then you see the net down at the bottom, particularly that orange line, again, excluding fixed income, global macro managers, our hedge fund managers are bringing their net down. The final, the 10th risk is, and last risk is permanent loss of capital. We showed this for the first time last October. We went back, really till UTIMCO was founded, 16 years, 683 investments have been made, totaling $55 billion. A little under 20% of those investments have suffered some loss of some kind. $8.8 billion of the $55 billion suffered some loss of some kind. But the losses have been relatively minor in the context of our total loss as a percentage of invested capital, 2.7%. And we did split out realized and unrealized. The reason why we put an unrealized in is because the purpose of this is to be timely and transparent about where we do have a loss of capital. And in the private equity book, for example, you know, a private equity fund may take 12 years to really wind up. But after about 7 or 8 years, it's pretty much baked. There may be one or two companies that still haven't kind of come to their end. So if we have a pretty good idea that we're going to suffer some permanent loss, we wanted to report that. And the good news is that we've got no, since July 31st, so over the last 6 months or 5 months, when we've looked at it, you know, we've got a couple investments that are currently in the red, but we don't think it'll be a permanent loss of capital, so no permanent loss of capital. So I apologize for the lengthy funds update, but wanted to give you that overview. And now I thought that I'd ask each of the investment officers to just briefly talk about their respective books.
So on page 57 of the board book, this is Russ Campy. If you'll take a look, I'd like to direct you to the upper left-hand corner. You know, the reason we're here is for the value add row. In 2014, it was another good year for the portfolio, as we added just under 3% above the benchmark.
That's more than a good year. In fixed income, that is incredible. You look at that 2.9, 2.1, 2.3, off to 1.0 start. I don't mean to jinx it, but in fixed income, that's incredible.
I'll knock on wood as well. Thank you, Bruce. You know, and really importantly to us, if you'll go down to the last row of that chart, the portfolio information ratio, we're very happy that we're able to continue to deliver that value add with actually less volatility than the benchmark. So, you know, the risk is not out of line with the returns that we're getting. If you move over to the pie chart on the right. A couple things to point out over the year. We did a manager transition during the year that I think most folks are familiar with, letting go of Old Mutual and hiring FIA, First International Advisors. They've gotten off to a very good start this year, over the last year, sorry. And as well as PIMCO, and all the Bill Gross transition, our former manager, Scott Mather, was bumped up to be a part manager of PIMCO Total Return, and Andrew Balls became the new portfolio manager for that account, and he's gotten off to a very good start as well. So I just wanted to note that. As you moved on to the next page, 58, a little more detail about the portfolio. The modified duration in the upper left-hand chart is a half a year short of the index. We're equal to the index going back to August. As rates have come down, our managers, I think, have found ways to shorten up the portfolio and found that more attractive. The overall yield to maturity of the portfolio is 90 basis points above the index. And the average rating is one notch short of the index, so pretty much in line, and that has not changed since August. Moving over to the upper right, the geographical exposure of the index. Probably the biggest position, and it's a little bit masked here by the comparison of the Asian Pacific aggregate exposure, is slightly over 10% underweight to Japan. The reason that the Asian Pacific aggregate exposure is much closer to the benchmark is that we have overweights in Australia and New Zealand. The emerging market overweight at 11.5% is primarily made of an overweight to Mexico of 7% and overweights to Brazil and South Africa of approximately 2% apiece. In the lower left-hand corner, you see our relative currency exposures. We have a large overweight to emerging markets. Once again, that's made up of Mexico, which is a 4% overweight. Chile, South Africa, India, and Malaysia are smaller, but not insignificant overweights. And once again, we have a heavy underweight to the euro, which has been a benefit to our portfolio. Finally, if you look in the lower right-hand corner in the sector exposures, we continue to have an underweight to the securitized sector. Primarily, that's driven by the fact that the Federal Reserve has made mortgage-backed securities so expensive relative to the rest of the market. And we see that through, I know in our internal portfolio as well as our outside managers, we all agree that's something we should avoid. And finally, we continue to be overweight to Treasury and sovereign exposure, and I think that's primarily driven by the fact that we see securitized as so rich. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Mr. Schoberg. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Warner, Natural Resources.
I'd actually prefer to Schoberg. Good morning, everybody. It's Mark Warner. I want to talk a little bit about the public equity and commodity futures portion of the portfolio. As a reminder, the public equity and commodity futures portfolios that the Natural Resources team manage are blended together to create our overall public natural resources portfolio. We like to split it into two separate portfolios to give you better transparency into what each is doing, because certainly commodities and equities are two very different asset classes. They both experienced a historic drawdown in the fourth quarter of calendar year 14. In particular, I'm sure everybody on the call is very well aware of what's going on in the energy complex broadly. What I can tell you is we've looked back at history, particularly the 08, 09 time frame, and this is historic by any measure, even going back to the early 70s in the oil complex. Although those lookbacks in history have given us some comfort as to where we are positioned relative to those. Specifically on the commodities portfolio, what I would tell you to put some context on this is when we last spoke in November, we were talking about performance for the 1, 3, and 5 year periods through August, so which would have been the end of fiscal 2014, our commodity portfolio had outperformed on a net basis by 200 basis points across the 1, 3, and 5 year time periods. The reason I point that out to you is what you see here, not only the absolute drawdown of commodities generally, which is shown in the upper left-hand box in the fiscal year-to-date 15, you know, the commodities complex itself is down almost 18%. Our portfolio is down a little over 20%. That all occurred in the last 4 months of the year, and that took all of our time periods into the red, with the exception of the 5 year time period. The point being there, of course, that it's a very concentrated, very short lived correction that we are still continuing to work our way through. We suffered, as I mentioned, a period of underperformance as well as negative performance overall in the commodity complex. The reason for that is we were overweight energy going into the correction, and we were underweight the agriculture sector. Our partners have the ability to make sector bets within commodities. Actually, the underweight to ags was a bigger detriment than the overweight to the energy sector. The overweight to the energy sector was far out on the curve, 8 or 10 months out on the commodity curve, which suffered less of a correction than did the prompt month contract. So that dampened the underperformance a bit, but overall, those two big positions were negative contributors to our relative performance. What I would say is we have a lot of confidence in this particular partner. Over their entire tenure with us, they've added a lot of value to our portfolio. We think they're well-positioned and they're deeply knowledgeable on a fundamental basis as to where the entire commodity complex is. To bear that out a bit, we've gained about 150 basis points back in January, just as kind of a flash update. So we're quickly, hopefully, narrowing that underperformance, and we have high hopes for the fiscal year that we will again be back in an outperformance mode. On the equity side, again, to remind you, we are measured against a broad global resources equities benchmark that is characterized by a lot of large cap international energy equities that have very low returns on equity and low growth rates. We choose to orient our portfolio in a much more high growth set of names, and we break the equity benchmark into several subsets, oil and gas producers, energy service companies, energy transportation companies, metals and mining equities, to name a few. Each of those are in a separate account with a customized strategy with a hand-picked partner. I think overall it represents a very bespoke equities portfolio. During periods of drawdowns in resource equities, we will underperform. What I would say is it's no fun, but it's also not a huge surprise. This is not dissimilar from what we've seen in history. What we've done to give ourselves confidence in where we're positioned is we've looked back at history and we've shown that through cycles, from peak to trough and then back to peak, we capture more of the ups than the downs, a similar analysis to what Bruce showed earlier, and our managers outperform smartly when markets recover. We have a lot of confidence in our managers. Many of them have been managing equity strategies in the resource space for decades. We tend to be their biggest client and their longest-term client, and so we have a lot of insight into the way they think about the sector. And so, as such, you know, it gives us confidence, although, as I said, the drawdown's no fun. We are underweight, as Bruce mentioned. We've taken a very constructive view to that, and we've been adding to both the commodities and the equities portfolios on a kind of a monthly basis, sort of dollar cost averaging, if you will, back towards an equal weight to policy. So our equal weight would be 5%, 2.5% each for commodities and equities. We're working back towards that 5% on kind of a monthly basis and also hoping markets bring us back in line. We're also discussing the notion that if we have a view that the energy markets will correct over time, and I think we do own that view, that the best way to probably capture that is the equity portion of our natural resources portfolio. And because it's broken into five separately managed strategies, we can have a highly targeted overweight, if we choose to do so, to try to capture the recovery in the oil markets. As yet, we don't have a specific plan around that, but I just wanted to share with the board that we are having those conversations. And I would say there's lots and lots of institutions that see that, you know, oil is half off of full retail from last year, and they're thinking about how to allocate to the sector. What I would point out to you is we're there, we have great partners, and it gives us, I think, a bit of an advantage, certainly from a timing perspective, that if we want to add exposure to what we think are some of the best partners in the world, we have the ability to do so. And with that, I'll pause and answer any questions.
All right, now, Mr. Schober, do you want to defer back to Mr. Warren?
Maybe so. You know, the $837 million of value you see there represents about 2.5% of the endowments and 3% of the ITF. You can see we've had, you know, attractive absolute performance on a 1-, 3-, and 5-year basis, but we've unfortunately continued to underperform the benchmark as we work to reposition the portfolio. You know, I'd like to highlight this. When you look at the exposure we have, you know, over 54% of that, those managers we now have in place there were all put in place over the last 4 months. We've had a heavy transition in the portfolio that we've worked through, and we feel pretty good about our positioning going forward. You know, Northwood Securities we added in December, and then the two Brookfield strategies we added back in August. And then the two remaining legacy exposures we have with Morgan Stanley and Cohen Steers are both groups that we've got confidence in. They've outperformed on, you know, all on the 1, 3, and 5 year basis. When we look back at the sort of the 5 years, there's really two inflection points, kind of not too dissimilar from kind of what the natural resources portfolio has experienced that I think are worth highlighting for us. The first was in 2011, and that was a time that we had really heavy overweight to Asia. And during that year, the U.S. markets were up 20%. Asia was up 7%, and that was pretty impactful to us. This was the issue with both of our global mandates, and that they had those weightings. One of our managers maintained his conviction, maintained the overweight, and the following year regained a lot of that underperformance when Asia was up 48% and the U.S. was up 16%. The other manager seemed to sort of reverse course, lost confidence. They ended up having some PM turnover, and we subsequently terminated that relationship. The second real inflection point was in last year, and we really had some challenges in the portfolio. The first was really market-based. You know, capital flows came into the REIT sector pretty heavily in search of yield, and that drove up valuations of lower quality firms. And as value investors in our portfolio, our managers tended to underperform in this market. You know, and that's an area that I think there was probably some reasoning for that. And you know, it's tough to argue against them in that they weren't sort of chasing the lower quality stuff in that market. So given the upswing we saw in the benchmark and the REIT index, them taking a little bit defensive position sort of made some sense. But the second two issues we had, one was an organizational issue with one of our favorite PMs that drove underperformance in the portfolio. As we looked to transition the portfolio to a new management team, we elected to take possession of the securities with the goal of transitioning to the team under their new umbrella. We really underestimated the impact of the PM's departure from the firm where they were, as they saw redemptions in excess of 80% of the total portfolio. This was a $10 billion portfolio, and it really impacted a lot of the security. So I think we were quick to sort of pull the plug, put our termination notice in, but unfortunately we maintained the securities, and as a lot of those redemptions came through, there was some devaluation of the assets. We think there's good value in there today. It's just going to take some time to get some of that defensive value back. And the third thing to highlight, and probably what was maybe the most painful for us and really has challenged our resolve in the first quarter, was a major underperformance we got from one of our new mandates. You know, this is a manager that we get a lot of tracking error from. We look to get our most relative performance out of there. Historically, they've outperformed by 1,100 basis points. But the reality is they have dramatic swings in their monthly performance. You know, I was just looking through and, again, looking at history for them. They miss by over 200 basis points, you know, close to 26% of the time on a monthly basis. And they, on the flip side, they outperform by those measures over, you know, almost 40% of the time. So, unfortunately, they have these dislocations where they miss, but it's often them going into trades early, and we wait to see those materialize. So, we're spending a lot of time. We're staying very close to them. It's been a rough first 4 months, but we still have confidence over the long term that they'll deliver that outperformance we're looking for. And all right. With that, I can pause for questions, too.
Susan?
Hi. The developed country portfolio at the end of December was $4.5 billion. It's still allocated about one-third each across the U.S. managers in blue in the pie chart on the right. Developed ex-U.S. managers in green and global managers in red. Looking at the box on the top left, relative performance continued to be strong from September to December 2014 with value add of over 5% over the MSCI World Benchmark.
So again, strong to deliver 500 basis points of outperformance in a long-only public equity book is incredible.
Knocking on wood, yes.
Knock on wood.
We are very happy with the performance. Fiscal year to date, that performance was driven primarily by our Japan manager combined with a yen hedge. Our U.S. managers, Value Act and Stellium, global managers, Viking and Maverick, and our Europe manager, AKO. We have been happy with the alpha over longer periods of time. For the full calendar year, December 2014, we had strong performance from our U.S. managers as well as Viking and our Japan manager in this. Fiscal year to date, we made no new investments, but withdrew about $260 million of capital, and that was just rebalancing back to get closer to Battle Country target weight in the portfolio. Next page shows our emerging market portfolio. Again, on the top left, we've been happy with the relative performance over the 1, 3, and 5 year periods.
Should I chime in that's incredible? Knock on wood.
For the calendar year 2014, our outperformance was driven primarily by our exposure to the China A-share market, which is not part of our benchmark, but was up 50% during the year, as Bruce mentioned earlier. We also had strong alpha from our China manager and our India manager, and this was slightly offset by our exposure to Russia, whereas Bruce mentioned the market was down 45% in U.S. dollar terms, but our Russia manager did outperform the market. Fiscal year to date, box bottom left, we made several additions. We added to Albizia, our Southeast Asia manager, to Petra, our Korea manager, Sagatree, another Asia manager, Westwood, a concentrated global emerging markets manager, and then smaller amounts to investments in Mexico, Korea, and China. And these were funded through withdrawals from our global emerging markets managers.
Terrific. A lot of hard work's gone into those books. Well, all of them, but
just
all the travel that you had to do. Yes, sir?
All this incredible performance you're talking about really sets a new benchmark for what the expectation is of this board. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hey, well, Bruce.
Yes, sir?
Do we? I can get it offline, but is it possible to put together a more detailed attribution analysis of where the value add is, we think is coming from? It's kind of the 80-20 rule or something?
Sure. Let us take we could give it to you as summary or as detailed as you want. As you might imagine, every one of the investment officers and their team spends an incredible amount of time with each manager, really going security by security. And when we have, twice a year, I'll sit down with each of the investment teams. We have our semi-annual reviews, and we'll go through all of that. And then periodically, we'll sit down and we'll take a deep dive on a manager like a Hill House. So, we've got it down to almost the security level, not necessarily with our hedge fund book, but even there we have a lot of detail. So, and then, we can, like I said, build it all the way up to the single number at the fund level. So maybe, we can talk some more, Arden, about what level you'd like to see it. But we can put that together. I'm thinking those earlier charts, the green, yellow, red charts, where we had total return. We also showed you volatility. We could do value add on that. Use that construct, Uzi, with value add, and that might be the clearest way to kind of look at it.
Well, I think that's helpful. Thank you. I think I'm actually thinking about the public equities and both developed and emerging, and at the manager level. So just to keep it simpler, not necessarily, hey, across all the public managers, we had a most return by owning Microsoft. But at the manager level, it'd be interesting to see a bit of an attribution analysis, if that's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. We can do that.
In terms of the excess return, the outperformance.
Absolutely. Okay. And the hedge fund book? You're welcome.
Yep, thanks, Bruce. So in 64 in diligent, 52 in paper copy, I would describe the more recent hedge fund performance as okay. Certainly not.
By the way, a few years ago, I called it ho hum. I think 1 year I said we had ho hum performance, and you know, I know I'm not the only one that hasn't forgotten that. I was going to call it so so. You called it okay. Is that what you called it?
Yeah. Luckily, we only had this conversation once every few years.
That's right.
So,
that's
And so the first four fiscal months of the year were up 1.5%, outperforming the benchmark by 70 basis points. And for calendar 2014, in absolute terms, we were up 4.4%, outperforming by 1.2%. On a relative basis, this compares to global equities that were up 4.2%. So in a more muted environment, we were had about 100% up capture. And if you compare that to 2013 in a very strong global bull market, we were up 16.6% versus 22.8%, and that was about 73% up capture. So we'd expect to lag in that kind of environment given the hedge nature. But over the full five-year period, we're up 8.3% versus global equities of 9.2%, and that's about 90% up capture versus 40 to 50% net exposure on average, so we feel good about that. The total portfolio is $11 billion. We're a little overweight in both the endowments and the ITF, close to 31% and 46% respectively. The pie chart shows we've been increasing the allocation to long-short equity on the margin and not really adding to credit or macro, and you know, very modestly added to event. As we look at the full year, long-short equity struggled initially.
The only one thing I'd add on the pie chart, the number in parentheses are the number of managers. This includes, correct me if I'm wrong, Ryan, managers where we're redeeming, but there's kind of a tail or a slow pay, you know, some stub positions. And so our active manager base is, you know, smaller than this.
Right. In fact, the pie chart is the number of funds, so it's even larger than the number of managers.
I say, I didn't think we had that many managers.
And then the chart in the middle that says concentration talks about our top 10, 20, 30 relationships.
Got it.
So 46% is in the top 10, and that's down from, you know, it was 50, 55% a few years ago, and the top 20 is 72%, and it used to be closer to 80%, but the portfolio's grown. Managers have been closed, and the managers we've been hiring we have very high conviction in. And as we pointed out on the leverage at the bottom, it has come down from about 50% net to 40% net. You know, in the recent sell-off, our managers will typically cut risk and preserve capital, so we're glad to see that. And then on the capital activity, it's been close to self-funding, about $142 million in net activity, and we've added two new managers. We've done two new funds with existing managers and had four terminations, and the rest is just rebalancing activity.
Terrific. On the next page, 65 in Diligent, 53 paper, is where we kind of summarize the private investment portfolio. I'll give some summaries and then ask Mark and Lindell if they want to hit on any highlights. You know, the summary is, and I'm going to look at the calendar year on page 65. We went in on January 1st, 2014, 27% of our portfolio, $6.3 billion, were in privates. If we fast forward, go to the right side of the page, at the end of the year, we were only at 28%. We had only grown from 27 to 28% of our portfolio, but the book had gone from $6.3 billion up to $7.2 billion. And you can see the unfunded commitments have gone from $4 billion up to $5.6 billion. So, you know, as we've communicated to the board really over the last 7 years and tried to do it kind of every year, we're on a we have a strategy to get our private investments up to about 33% of the portfolio. You know, that'll take another 3 or 4 years on a base case. There's a big drop in public markets like there was in 2008, we could get to that 33% or more awfully quickly. But so that's why you see the unfunded commitment number rising. During the course of the year, we had $1.5 billion of that capital called, but we had $1.7 billion, $1,682,000,000 of distributions. So we actually had more money coming out of our private book than going into it, you know, for the year. We did, however, also have $1 billion of markups in the book. You know, in the old days, private investments didn't mark their books. In the new days, under accounting standards, they need to. They're required to. So we do see those markups. You know, overall, we had a 16.1% return in our private portfolio for the year. And, you know, everything was positive. Lindell, I don't, and then the final columns, you see we made 52 fund commitments, almost $3 billion during the year. Lindell, I don't know if there's anything in particular you want to highlight in your areas.
Maybe a couple points. Similar to Ryan's, it's more concentrated than it would appear. We measure the number of funds here. There's a good many of those that are tail-end funds with low NAV associated with them, and a good many that are new funds across several groups, obviously in real estate and natural resources where we've been ramping up. But also true in developed country equity, our other piece. It's a relatively young portfolio we've been reshaping. And you see that reflected in the performance of that row as well. I would note that credit continues to run off that top row. You see distributions well in excess of calls. That's something we've been working on for a number of years. We're happy to see that occurring as expected. And that we base our commitment targets on a fiscal year rather than a calendar year, and you're catching a very cyclically busy time for us. It spans across two fiscal years here. So it was a very active calendar year, but it fit across the two fiscal years. It's not quite so large a number.
And I'd point out the venture book, you know, has been terrific. And the emerging market book, it's nice to see that that's positive. And, you know, we have been building that book, so a lot of the investments going in are new investments. Mark Schoberg, any comments you want to make on a 23.3% annual increase in the real estate private book?
Yeah, I think, that was a great year for us. We're happy with those numbers. And the thing I'd probably really highlight about that is when, you know, we look at the private real estate index, I think the index returned about 11%, so it's a pretty significant change, and that's also with us running at 120, almost 125% of unfunded on our portfolio, so we probably got a heavier drag than the more mature index. And then the second thing to highlight there is a lot of that's not just marks, but we got a lot of realizations out of our portfolio. You know, the 300 of distributions on 800 is showing our managers are really getting in there, adding their value, and clearing these assets as they feel like they've sort of maximized value. So we feel really good about the distribution activity we're getting as well.
And then finally, natural resources, Mark Warner, 19.8 is not too shabby. And I don't know if you want to make any comments and also maybe any – you shared with us some thoughts about what you thought the marks might look like that we'll be getting in the next few months.
Yeah, well, and our goal would be to get out of the not-too-shabby quadrant into the really spectacular quadrant. But, look, it was a good year for us, certainly in the context of a very soft commodity price environment, to put it mildly, to have our portfolio appreciate by 20% was really encouraging. Obviously, we did get, as well, some significant distributions. What I'd point out is, if, for example, in the fourth quarter of last year, we had two distributions, both of them energy-related companies. One, we made four times our money net in less than 2 years. One, we made about three times our money net in less than 2 years. Both of those were sale processes that were started in the summer and closed in the fourth quarter. Both were realizations that were well above where they were marked in the portfolios at the time. So it illustrates a bit of the phenomenon of private equity that there can be significant value in portfolios that isn't recognized in the valuations. What I'd also say is our portfolio isn't just energy. It's very broad. It's very global. It includes lots of private equity investments in agriculture. infrastructure, mining globally. And I think as we go forward in time, you'll see more and more of that value be represented outside the U.S. and outside North America. What I'd finally point out is a couple of things. If you look at the far right on the natural resources line, we have a net asset value of $1.6 billion, but an unfunded commitment of $1.9. What I can tell you is that's closer to $2.2 now, because we closed a $200 million commitment early in January. The point there is we have some terrific partners throughout the world that have capital available to them to take advantage of some of these dislocations. We think we're incredibly well positioned, and we are hoping that unlike what we saw in 08 and 09 when energy prices and commodity prices crashed, there wasn't a lot of private equity activity because people didn't want to transact. They didn't want to get diluted, or they didn't want to sell their businesses or their assets at a discount. We're hoping our partners are able to be opportunistic this way. They have the money to do it. So we're very encouraged by where we are in the cycle and by the partnerships that we have.
One thing I'd point out, just for the board's sake, is when you look at the NAV as of 12/31, what we're really capturing there are values as of 9/30. And the 12/31 values will be rolled into our numbers for the next calendar year as they come in. They're just beginning to come in for privates on our side. We expect quite positive marks, but these just reflect 9/30.
That's a great point.
And what I'd say, Bruce, you'd ask me to comment on marks as well. I do expect to have some marks down in our energy private equity positions. However, I don't expect them to be anywhere near the magnitude of what we've seen in the public markets for a couple reasons. One is our managers are quite hesitant to write things up. As Bruce mentioned, they tend to only write things up when the auditors sort of force them to. So they're very conservative in their marks.
They don't get paid on unrealized gains.
And they understand that it's a cyclical business, and there's no sense in writing things up and then writing them down. So there may be some marks down. I expect on a portfolio basis that's certainly to be in the single digits quarter over quarter. And what I would also say is we generally have very conservative capital structures. We don't have a lot of levered private equity companies in our portfolio that have any sort of survivability issues. And so I don't expect, as a result, to see dramatic marks down in the portfolio.
And Mark Schoberg, my guess is your marks will probably be positive as well.
I think we'll be positive. We'll see some impacts on some currency movements,
right.
Some of our European stuff.
Just to finish up on private investments, on page 67 in Diligent, 55 in paper, this is our co-investment pipeline and portfolio. For the fiscal year, if you look over on the right, we actually committed to 15 co-investments totaling $182 million. For that last 4 months, the first, fiscal quarter for 2015, were three of those investments. So that brings our total on the far right to 35 co-investments, almost $800 million. So, about $24 million per co-investment. We have some small co-investments. Again, I'm on the top left. Real estate had 5 co-investments, only $38 million. And that's because, sometimes our partners will offer us $2 million or $3 million co-investments. We like it. We don't spend a ton of time on those deals. We've got a pretty streamlined internal process for doing it. But we do like the larger co-investments, and, we work on those. The last thing I'd point out is down at the bottom of the page under where, in terms of what our returns are, it's still way too early to know, although we now have fully monetized, I think, 2 investments, both in natural resources, and Mark, I think, spoke to them earlier. They've both been very strong gains in relatively short periods of time. So if we can extrapolate from that, we're in good shape. We can't extrapolate from that, we'll see how this portfolio continues to develop.
In particular, with ours, at least for the co-investments, we see the auditors going through a process at 12/31, and that's where you see a real move and valuations.
Right.
So we'll see.
So we'll see.
Stuff coming in over the quarter.
So it doesn't look horrible yet. Still too early to tell, and it's always nice to get out of the gate well. Lastly, just on the ITF, it's on page 69. It is a substantial amount of money, $6.8 billion. We've got about 30% of that portfolio in investment-grade fixed income and about 40-45% in our hedge fund book. We've talked about investment grade. It's the same managers, the same strategies, the same good value add, same thing in the hedge fund book. It's incredibly liquid, and so we don't spend as much time on it because there's not anything necessarily different about it. We just have a different strategic asset allocation and therefore kind of a set of returns. No contracts to report on, and that's the fund's update, and I'm 7 minutes too long, so I apologize to you, Mr. Chairman, for that.
Well, with that kind of good performance, we'll cut you a little slack. I think, one, I would say in the time I've been on the board, this is an excellent review in terms of where we are, transparency of what's going on, et cetera. And I'd like to congratulate the group not only on the performance but on the report, what y'all have gone through today. I think it's also important that very seldom do you hear from the legislatures, at least, that, UTIMCO is really the model. In fact, they even discussed in one of the recent finance meetings, I think, that maybe they need to put more of the money in the hands of UTIMCO from other places because our returns seem to be superior to others. So very seldom do you get an attaboy from them, so put that one on the wall.
Mr. Chairman, in full disclosure, it didn't last long. Chancellor McRaven immediately sent me an email saying, don't let it go to our heads, and we need to get back to work and make more money.
That's what you would expect from your chancellor.
Absolutely. And I've got,
I told him it was too late.
The chancellor and I agree, and I've got a point on that in just a moment. The other thing I'd like to say, I guess, is some of the recent press, assuming it's right, said we are now ahead of Harvard. So that's a good field position that now as we look forward, we don't see anybody. Now we got to realize that when you're behind, you tend to work harder to catch up. So another reason to do what the chancellor's saying, what are you going to do for me tomorrow? And in that regard, the last comment I'd like to make on this section, at least, is, when you look at what we've withdrawn from the fund in the last few years, the 7% last year, and I guess 5+ the previous year, and you look at the coming year, and although, maybe we're going to be okay, I don't know. There's been a lot of surprises here in the last 6 months. There's probably some more coming around the corner. But when you look at UTIMCO and you look at it as a whole part, also including West Texas Lands, I guess last year we were seeing roughly $100 million a month from West Texas Lands. That number's probably closer to $50 million right now. And this is difficult for you to do, I know, just simply because you're only looking at the UTIMCO piece of it. But I think it would be good for you all to take a look and report back to this board here in the first quarter, with, let's say, $50 million coming from University Lands and your best estimate of what you think we may do this year. What's that say about a distribution, I don't think any of us are thinking about 7%, but I think each of us, whether it be A&M or whether it be Texas, if we were looking at something like 3%, it might cause us to reevaluate some of the things we're doing. So looking at that dashboard, I think it would be good to give us some of your wisdom and judgment in that regard. Chancellor, I assume you feel the same way.
I do. Thank you.
We'll be happy to look at it.
Are there any other comments or questions on this report?
Yeah, Chairman Foster, what I'd just say to that end is a handful of us had a conversation with the folks in West Texas a week ago just to get an update on what they're seeing. on receipts, and you're right, it's closer to 50 million. I think it's a bit above that. And we've kind of looked at what it's going to be on a full fiscal year basis. And it's certainly down year over year, not maybe quite as dramatically as one would think relative to the prices of the commodity. But the point being, they've been really thoughtful about staying current and talking to the operators out there and getting a sense of what activity is going on, and that's certainly helpful to us to perform the analysis you just requested.
All right, that's good. I appreciate that. If there are no further comments, then we've got two reports. And I heard John go off earlier. I'm assuming John's back. John, are you there?
I am back. I just thought
that was good.
Are you ready?
With the Audit and Ethics Committee report to you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Audit and Ethics Committee convened by teleconference on January 30th. We had Directors Hobson, Stillwell, and myself present, and Chairman Foster also joined us telephonically. We heard reports from Robert Calley, the engagement partner from Deloitte and Touche, on audit results for the corporation. Then we heard reports on quarterly compliance matters from Sissing. And then finally, Joan reported on the unaudited financial statements. We considered three action items. First, we approved the minutes of the meeting held on November 4th, 2014. Then we had a resolution regarding Deloitte & Touche's financial statement audit results and communications on the audit of the corporation, which we approved, subject to this board's approval. And then finally, we had the third action item was the annual financial statements and audit report of the corporation, which was also approved by the committee, subject to this board's approval. And you have all the materials in the board books on page 73 of the board books electronically. You have two resolutions that were approved by the audit committee, which we recommend approval by this board. And that is the resolutions I just mentioned. One, the financial statement and audit results for the year ended August 31st, 2014, by Deloitte & Touche. And secondly, the annual financial statements and audit report for the corporation for the fiscal years ended August 31st, 2014, and August 31, 2013. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll move approval of those two resolutions.
Second.
All right. Any discussion? If none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. Good. Thank you. Motion carried. We'll now go to the report from the Risk Committee, and I guess in the absence of Mr. Bass, that you will do that, Bruce.
Yes, I'll be happy to. I want to add one thing on the Audit Committee. Those are the people. Those are the people that were on the phone call. May recall that Joan and I had a difference of view as to how we reported our actual versus budgeted expenses. Joan and I, and this is real important to me because it's important to me that we are transparent and clear with you about everything, particularly our own expenses. Turns out Joan and I were both right. We were kind of looking and thinking about some different things. I was looking at whenever in our board meeting in the UTIMCO update section, we give you an update on our expenses, that's always kind of apples to apples. The issue here was capitalizing expenses associated with our technology build-out. And so when we went back and looked at the board updates on actual versus budget performance, it was like versus like. And even Joan didn't give herself as much credit as I thought she should have, because in her schedule, in the back of the Audit and Ethics book, the actual versus budget on a line item basis is apples to apples until you get to the very bottom where we add back in or credit the $800,000 of capitalized expenses, which we didn't have in the budget. So if you looked at only the very bottom line, it wasn't in Joan's schedule, it wasn't apples to apples, but in everything else it was. And so I just wanted to clarify that point, because I didn't want Mr. White or anybody else worried about how whether we were trying to pull one over on you about how we spent our money. On the risk committee, Kyle Bass was there along with Ardmore and Lee Hildebrand. I don't believe John was able to make it because it was a brief meeting. Morris Foster was also on the call. We approved the minutes, or they approved the minutes. They approved the mandate categorizations, which were quite straightforward, and heard the compliance report from CISI, which I think was pretty darn clean. And that's what we did in that meeting. And there's no action items for this board.
All right, Bruce. I guess that concludes the business we had scheduled today. Is there any other business? If none, I'd like to thank everyone for their participation today, and particularly you, Chancellor. Welcome to the team. And I'm sure this is another one of those occasions where you walk away and you say, oh, my goodness, this is that. This is the cash cow that makes us all feel very good. There are a lot of other universities around the world that would love to have it. But hopefully you've seen today that we've got a good team. We've also got a good board that's managing it. So we welcome your participation.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be part of it. Thanks very much.
Good. If there's no other business, we'll consider the meeting adjourned.
Thank you.
Bill McRaven
has left the conference.